So I want to show a picture of someone, and when I show the picture, it'll be interesting to see what the feel of the room is. And so whether you're here or in Classics or Springboro or Northmont, just notice the feel of the room when I show the picture. That's Richard Nixon, obviously, and Richard Nixon has left quite the impression on a lot of people. And some generations in this room really know his story and his legacy that he left. But Richard Nixon was a very interesting guy. I don't know if you know this, but he was actually a very popular vice president under Dwight Eisenhower. And then he ran for president and won, had a four-year term, and did many good things. Some things we would agree with, some things maybe we wouldn't agree with, and was actually a pretty popular president. And then he ran again for his second term, and he actually won the most popular vote ever at that time. He won 49 out of 50 states. And if you know anything about Richard Nixon, when we think of Richard Nixon, that's not what we think of, is it? We think of a man who blew up his legacy, who made some bad choices. And Richard Nixon was a very interesting guy. He was considered or called what would be like an old school president, like he held no prisoners. He was very in your face about things. In fact, he was so much like this, he actually had an enemies list. If you know history at all, you probably know this. He had a long enemies list and a short enemies list. On the short list was about 20 people, and on the long enemies list was a bunch of people included. And what I find very interesting is some of the people who were on his enemies list. And so I want to show you who those were. Joe Namath was on his enemies list. And I don't know why, I don't know what happened between them, I don't even know if they knew each other, but he was on the enemies list. And so was Steve McQueen. I don't know why, I don't know the story back then, I don't know, I was born in the 80s, so I don't know what happened there. Not trying to rub that in or anything, I promise. And then this guy, Paul Newman. For the younger generations, this is the salad dressing guy. For the older generations, this is the actor. But I don't know why Paul Newman was on the enemies list, but he was. And so those were some people who were on his enemies list, and I don't know why, but 2 years after Richard Nixon won with the most popular vote ever, he would blow up his presidency. And he'd become a president who resigned in complete disgrace. And he had an enemies list. He had a long one and a short one. And in the end, an enemy did bring him down. But the enemy that brought him down was not on his list. Because the person that brought Richard Nixon down was Richard Nixon. He was his own worst enemy. And all of us in this room have people who don't like us. Maybe people we would even refer to or refer to us as enemies. But as we look at the life of Saul today, here's the truth we want to look at. You will be the most difficult person you will ever deal with. You will be the most difficult person you will ever deal with. Satan tempts us and he attacks us, and I think too often, though, we blame him for the fact that we can't figure ourselves out. And we can figure other people out, we can figure out family, we can figure out friends, but at the end of the day, we have a hard time figuring ourselves out. And so, I hope you don't have an actual enemies list. Like, I hope you don't have one that you're keeping track of your enemies or something. But if you did, at the top of that list, in big, bold letters, highlighted and circled, you should write your name. Because you will be the one who brings you down faster than anyone else will. And I will be the one who brings myself down faster than anyone else. So if you've grown up in church or have any church experience at all, you'll probably know a little bit of the backstory with King Saul. And King Saul is another man in the Bible who stirs up lots of emotions. But get this, I don't think it's an accident that God gave us 32 chapters in intimate detail about the life of King Saul, another person who would blow up his life, who would blow up his legacy. So we have 32 chapters, and we're not going to read 32 chapters today, I promise. But in the case of Saul, there are three very predictable steps that caused him to self-destruct. And I'll get to those in a few minutes. But these three steps have been the case of every single person who's ever self-destructed their own life. And so go ahead and take your Bibles or turn in your device to 1 Samuel chapter 9. And as you're finding that, we are going to hit some highlights of different chapters, so we may do a little more reading than we normally do, but it's going to give us a great look into the life of Saul and ultimately teach us some incredible lessons. So please don't tune out on me with all the reading we do, and I think what we have to talk about today is very important. So as you're turning to 1 Samuel chapter 9, I need to catch you up a little bit on the backstory of the Israelites. So the Israelites wanted a king. They had never had a king. They were ruled by judges, and God was their king. It's the way God set it up to be. God would raise people up who would speak on his behalf, the prophets, and then he'd use the judges for decisions, and it was a great setup. But there came a day when the Israelites said, "We want a king." And I was thinking about why they wanted this. So why would you think they wanted a king? Because all the other nations had kings. Everybody around them had kings. And I can just imagine that they would have these big celebration days, these other nations, and on these celebration days, the king would come through town, and he would ride in, and his whole posse would be behind him, and they would give him gifts and lay garland and just be able to love on that king and worship that king even. And I can just imagine a conversation taking place between one of these people in these nations and in the nation of Israel, and them asking one of the Israelites, "Where's your king?" "Well, God is our king," they would respond. I said, "Oh, really? Well, does he ever show up?" "No, not really." "Well, what's his name?" "We really can't say his name because all we know him is Yahweh." "So is he gonna show up, or is he one of your many gods? Because we have 12,000 gods." And they said, "No, he is the one and only God." And as they would have these celebration days, maybe they wanted someone in person to honor. So they go to Samuel, the person that God was speaking through at this time, and said, "Hey, we want a king." And it breaks Samuel's heart. Samuel says, "You have a great setup," but it breaks his heart. So Samuel goes to God and says, "God, they want a king. It breaks my heart." But God says to Samuel, "Don't worry about it, because it's not you they are rejecting. It's me they're rejecting." And so God gives them a king. And sometimes the worst thing that can happen is for God to give us what we want. I don't know if you look back at your life like I do mine, but I think of times where I really wanted something and God saved my life by not giving it to me. And you can probably relate to that. God gave them what they wanted. He gave them a king, and he gave them a man named Saul. And first impressions are everything. And when we first read about Saul in Scripture, it's in 1 Samuel 9, verse 2 and 3, and it says this: "Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else." This is where it gets interesting. "Now the donkeys belonging to Saul's father, Kish, were lost, and Kish said to his son Saul, 'Take one of the servants with you and go look for the donkeys.'" Saul was a donkey chaser. And not a very good one if you keep reading. It took him a long time to find it. A prophet had to get involved, and he was a donkey chaser. So if first impressions are everything, we're not getting a great start at the look of this guy's life. He was tall. He was good looking. But the thing with Saul is his inside never matched his outside. On the outside, he looked great. On the outside, he was it. He was tall. He was fit. He was handsome. Saul looked like a tall Brad Pitt, but he acted like Adam Sandler. That was Saul. He looked great. And maybe Saul's father thought, "Okay, I finally have a job that Saul can do. Go find my lost donkeys." So he's chasing donkeys, and that's the start to his life that we read. But at this point in his life, he's done nothing wrong. It's not his fault he was so good looking. It's not his fault he was tall and handsome and carried himself very kingly. But let me ask you a question. What do you do when you make a better first impression than you can perform? What do you do when you come across better than you can actually produce? That's an interesting question. And as I was thinking about that and evaluating my life, I thought about, do people stay in my life? Or do people stay in your life? Or do you notice that after people get to know you a little bit, they tend to pull away because they got past the first you? They got past the impression you wanted them to have. They got past the filter that propped up you. They got past all that, and the real you came out. And as I look at my life, I ask myself, do people stay in my life, or do they tend to move on to other things after they really get to know me? So when you make a better first impression than you can perform, or when you come across better than you can produce, what do? Because at this moment, there's a why in the road. We can do one of two things. We can honestly embrace our strengths and work on our weaknesses, or we can say this: I have to keep up this image. I make a good impression, so I have to pretend. I have to continue to play the part. And if we make that awful decision like Saul chooses to do, we will spend the rest of our life and all of our time and energy and resources and strength pouring into a facade that's not really us. We will live an exhausting life trying to be something on the outside that we know we're not on the inside. That's exactly what happens to Saul. And real quick, before we look at any more verses, I have to tell you, this is especially sad for Saul, because God did something for Saul that was so unique and so special in the Old Testament. God did something for him that he didn't do for very many people in the Old Testament, because God knew he was good at playing games. God knew Saul was an image manager. God knew that. So God calls him to be king, but God did not ask him to do something that he wasn't going to give him the ability to do. So in 1 Samuel chapter 10, starting in verse 6, we see a very unique thing and special thing that God does for Saul. Verse 6, it says, "The Spirit of the Lord will come powerfully upon you, and you will prophesy with them, and you will be changed into a different person." As Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart. And all these signs were fulfilled that day. When he and his servant arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him, and then listen to this, the Spirit of God came powerfully upon him. God gave Saul a new heart and the Spirit of God to guide him. Here's an important word for us to remember. God gave Saul the capacity to be on the inside what he looked like on the outside. And he does that same thing for us when we accept Christ. When we give our life to him, he gives us his Spirit and gives us the capacity to be everything he's calling us to be. And he won't call us, nor did he call Saul, to be something he wouldn't give him the ability to do. So God did all these great things for Saul, chose him to be king, gave him the capacity to be a successful king, but Saul never embraced it. In Saul's mind, he was always a donkey chaser playing the part of a king. And as we read the story of Saul, it's like over and over again, God is saying to him, "Saul, if you would just trust me, you will be a good king." But it's like over and over again, Saul's response is, "If they ever knew the real me, they wouldn't let me be king." I think he always felt like a donkey chaser, not qualified for what he's been asked to do. And I think we should stop right here for a moment, because it's a sad thing that a lot of us live this way. If the people around us knew the real me, if the people around you knew the real you, life might be different for you. And so I had some thoughts as I was working through this. I just want to put up here and process through. If my wife ever found out who I really was, she'd leave me, and maybe you can relate to that. If my wife or my husband ever knew the real me, if she ever could see past the filter and the propped up image I want her to see or I want him to see, then they would leave me in a heartbeat. If my boss really knew me, He'd fire me in a heartbeat. Because you know you. If my parents, students, if my parents knew me like I knew me, they would be so disappointed. Because you know you. You know the worst parts of you. You know everything about you. And so we prop up an image and we put on a filter. If my friends knew the habit I have, they wouldn't be my friends anymore. Or maybe this. If those church people knew me like I knew me, they wouldn't treat me the same. So we go into image management mode. And we begin to play a role. We become an actor on stage. And the sad thing is that some people live to be 70 and 80, 90 years old, having never really met themselves because they've played a part on a stage their entire life. They've been playing a role. God told Saul, "I want you to be a king." What Saul heard was, "I want you to play the part of a king." There's a huge difference. In the next chapter, chapter 11, you're welcome to turn there, we see Saul's very first test. Very first test as a king. There was this king named Nahash, and he was getting ready to attack a particular part of Israel. All the Israelites in that area were afraid. They knew this king and his army was going to come in and destroy them, so they were panicking, and the children of Israel were worried. And so they go to this foreign king, and they say to him, "Don't come kill us. Don't come destroy us. Just take us as slaves. We'll just surrender, and we'll be your slaves forever. It'll be the end of the story of the Israelites. We'll be your slaves." And King Nahash said, "Okay," and it's kind of gruesome, but he said, "But first, I have to gouge out the eye of every one of you." Now that's gruesome, but it had a very particular military reason back then. And if you're the children of Israel, you're really contemplating this in this moment. You're so worried. Not only are you about to be slaves, you're also about to lose an eye, all of you. And this should have outraged the children of Israel. So the children of Israel say, "Give us 7 days to think about it. Give us 7 days. And then Saul finds out about this. Saul finds out about it. First test as a king, and 1 Samuel 11, verse 7, Saul does something pretty amazing. It says he took a pair of oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent the pieces by messengers throughout Israel, proclaiming, "This is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel." It's very important that you notice that. He says Saul and Samuel. "Then the terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out together as one." So Saul does this as a message to everyone, saying, "This is what's going to happen to anybody who doesn't go with us to fight. This is what's going to happen to anybody who doesn't go with me and Samuel to fight." In this moment, he's doing things God's way. He's following the man of God, Samuel. He's on track. He's doing well. Saul rallies the troops, and 300,000 men show up. And they go and destroy King Nahash and his armies. And then after this amazing victory, all the people are celebrating like you do after victories. And they're celebrating, probably talking smack. And then in verse 12, he does something even more amazing. It said, "Then the people said to Samuel, 'Who was it that asked, shall Saul reign over us? Turn these men over to us so that we may put them to death.'" They're saying, "Let's get rid of the people who didn't want Saul to be king. This is our chance, because look, Saul led a victory. He's great." But then in verse 13, Saul said, "No one will be put to death today, for this day the Lord has rescued Israel." This is a great Saul. This is the Saul who could have been. If the period in his life was here, we would know him as a completely different person. This is the Saul that knew it was all about God. It wasn't about him. Man, if this were the end of his life, that would be amazing. But from here on out, we have 29 more chapters where we see his descent. From here on out, he starts his descent into destruction. And we're going to learn the first step of self-destruction. And I give you these so that you can recognize them in your life and I can recognize them in my life. And if any of these three are present, then red flags ought to go up in our life and we should realize that we're probably being an image manager and not being what God called us to be. The first step to causing our own destruction and the first step in Saul's life was that he compromising a non-negotiable. Saul compromised a non-negotiable. I'm going to show that to you. What we have happening in Saul's life is yet another battle, yet another struggle, another war, and this time it's with the Philistines. And what's been made very clear to Saul is that Saul is the king, Samuel is the prophet. Saul is the morale booster, Samuel is God's man. So, political, spiritual, and under no terms should those things combine. Let Samuel handle spiritual, Saul, you handle the political. But in 1 Samuel chapter 13, to skip time, you can read those verses on the notes and stuff or read them later. But what happened is Saul offers a burnt sacrifice himself, which is a spiritual thing, not a political thing. And that may not seem like a big deal, and it's not a big deal if you don't consider blasphemy a big deal. So to God, this was a big deal. Saul, this was not your role. Saul, you're playing a part. And I'm sure Saul's excuse was that the soldiers were waiting, they were getting mad, I was losing them, I had to play to the crowd, I had to do something to keep them excited. And so he offers the sacrifice himself. And for God, Saul offering the sacrifice was not up for debate. It was a non-negotiable. God made it clear how it was supposed to be. So he compromised the non-negotiable. And I haven't been involved in ministry for a long time compared to a lot of people I know. But for the several years I've been involved in it and the hundreds, literally, of teenagers and adults that I've gotten to know, one thing has been true about all of them who have self-destructed. It started, and they can trace it back, to when they compromised a non-negotiable. And I bet you know that to be true in the people you know who've self-destructed as well. For instance, anyone who's ever committed adultery and lost their marriage, it started when they compromised a non-negotiable and stepped across a line, something that was never supposed to be up for debate, not doing what they agreed to. So they crossed a line, maybe even a line that they never imagined they would have crossed. For Saul, God was the one who made it clear that he was not to do the sacrifices, but he did them anyways. So what do we do when we compromise a non-negotiable? When we do something we thought we would never do, what's our next step? Because then we tend to lose any sense of direction and we end up doing things our own way. So after compromising a non-negotiable, we do the next thing we only know how to do and we begin to write our own script. We begin to write our own script just like Saul does. So the progression goes like this. If I'm not going to follow God's script, then the only other choice is to write my own script. And it's true for Saul. In 1 Samuel 15, God tells Saul, I want you to go destroy these Amalekites, destroy everything about them. They've done harm to the Israelites, go destroy their king, their cattle, their houses, everything. Don't bring anything back, destroy it all. And if you know the story, you know that Saul did about half of what God asked him to do. They did exactly what God said not to do with half of the stuff and brought it back, the best stuff, even brought the king back. So Samuel, God's man, finds Saul and calls him out on this, confronts him. And Saul says, it was my army who did it, not me. And you can read this, it's all there. And I can imagine at this point, Samuel was getting fed up with Saul. And then Saul's excuse was, we brought the best stuff back so that we can offer it to God. We want to make it a sacrifice to him, which isn't Saul's role, again. And then Samuel makes this famous statement that you've probably heard before in 1 Samuel 15, verse 22. He starts by saying, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord?" And then this is what he says. You've heard this before. He says, "To obey is better than sacrifice." Obedience is better than sacrifice. Saul, I wish you would have just did what I said. So please listen closely. We live in a day where it's very easy for us to say, "I know what God said, but." That's exactly what Saul did. "I know what God said, but." Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and write my own thing here. And it's very easy for us to step over the line, compromise a non-negotiable that God has told us in his word not to compromise, and then we have to write our own script. And when God says that to obey is better than sacrifice, he's telling us something crazy important. Because when I think of 21st century American Christianity, I see Christians who claim to follow Christ, myself included, but we tend to compromise so many things, so many non-negotiables, sexual and parental and relationship issues and all these non-negotiables, stepping across the line and justifying it and saying, "Well, it's okay because I go to church when I can," or "It's okay because I get my verse of the day notification," or "It's okay because I teach a class," and we justify and we write our own script. See, it's cool. I've made room for God right here. He shows up again in Act 2, Scene 3. He'll show up again in Act 4. You'll see him. Like I said, I'm doing my own thing, but I fit God in. And when God tells Samuel to tell Saul that to obey is better than sacrifice, God is telling Nathan Jager and all of us here today this: I want you to do what I say. I don't want to be written into your script. And it was hard for Saul to hear, and it's hard for me to hear. So Saul writes his own script, and the story goes on and on for about 20 more chapters. 20 more chapters, we see Saul messing up. Error after error. But the last thing in this progression of destruction that happens is probably the worst. Because this particular thing we tend to see over and over again in his life. So after you've compromised a non-negotiable, we have to do the only thing we can do at that point and write our own script. And then what really hurts is when we do this. We push away those whom God sends to help you. Saul did this over and over again. And Samuel came to him time and time and time again and tried to call him out on some things. And Saul would have excuse after excuse after excuse. He would lie, he'd make an excuse, and then he would apologize for image sake. So Saul ultimately ended up pushing away the help that Samuel was offering. A guy named, a young David before he was king came along, killed a giant on behalf of Saul, actually made Saul look very good in doing that. But it ended up bothering Saul so much that he spends the rest of his life chasing down David and trying to kill him. Until ultimately, with another bad decision, an act of disobedience, Saul ends up taking his own life. And that's the period at the end of his life. Much different than what could have been. So when we compromise a non-negotiable, then we'll have to write our own script. And then if we push away the people that God's trying to help us, when you think about that for a moment, I don't want this to be my story. I don't want this to be my legacy. I don't want this to be your story. I don't want this to be teenager stories. Saul's legacy is now ruined, and it could have been so much different. Imagine what could have been. Man, imagine it for a moment. His story could have been, I was just out chasing donkeys one day. God somehow was able to use me to make me king, so I became king of this awesome nation, and I just trusted God, and he did amazing things for me, and all the glory goes to God. That could have been his legacy. Instead, his legacy is that he was an image manager. He would never step off the stage. He was always performing and never being. It's a big difference. So that's all great. That's the life of Saul, legacy. But what about us today? You know, when I look at my own life, I'm disappointed in how much time I've spent playing to the crowd. It saddens me to think of all the times that I became an image manager. And I don't want to spend another second of my life pretending. God never asked us to cover things up. We can read the Bible cover to cover, and that's never expected out of anyone. He never asked us to pretend like everything is okay. All he asks out of us is to come just as we are, with all our weakness and all our drama and all our habits, all our garbage, everything. Come just as we are. There's another guy named Saul in the Bible. Hundreds of years later, you know him as Paul, but his name started as Saul and was even probably named after this King Saul. But this Saul's story is different. In Romans chapter 7, and we don't have time to read it, please read it sometime, Paul is having this battle with himself. He's saying, I want to do good, but I don't do it. And there's things I should do that I don't do. And he's having this battle with himself, the battle with his biggest enemy, himself, and he knows that. And he's talking about all this stuff, and he comes to the conclusion, he says, I'm a miserable person because I can't figure myself out. But then before he's done talking in that chapter, he has this phrase that says, thanks be to God who delivers me through Jesus Christ. See, the solution to the battle with myself is found in Christ Jesus. Because Jesus is the only person who loves the worst me, the unfiltered me, the donkey chasing me. God loves that me. And someone in this room today needs to know that there is someone out there who you don't have to keep playing a part for. You don't have to keep pretending. You don't have to keep the filter up. You can come just as you are. Step off of the stage, resign from being an image manager. Because don't you ever wish that somebody would come along and love the worst you, the you that's in bed eating Cheetos at 11 o'clock at night on your fifth Netflix episode, and it's wondering if you're still there or not. Don't you wish someone would come along and love that you? Because that's the you that God loves. That's the you you wouldn't show anyone. You wouldn't want people to know that about you. But then God comes along and loves us, the worst us. Paul very clearly told us that, thank God, the answer is in Jesus Christ. And church, because of this, we can resign from being an image manager because it's exhausting living that way. Saul always felt like he was performing, but Paul comes along and reminds us that we're not fooling anyone. It's not too late to deal with your worst enemy. Jesus Christ is the answer. Rest in him. Take a deep breath. Stop playing a role and be you. And God will give you the strength and the ability to be what he called you to be. So would you close your eyes and bow your heads for a moment, please? We always take a couple minutes at the end of the service to just reflect and see maybe how God is speaking to our hearts. And I hope after looking at the life of Saul that you can just take a deep breath and know that not everything depends on you, that everything will be okay if we will just trust God and stop trying to control our image. So take two minutes now and pray for a moment.